Happy New Year, everyone. This is our continuation of the Guiye reading group, where we're continuing our reading of Cybernetics and the Origin of Information. We're still on chapter two, or at the end of the chapter. I think we may finish it today. So we're picking up on page 55. Slight confusion starting out today about where exactly we finished last time. We may be rereading a little bit to pick up from the end of where we were last time. But yeah, nothing wrong with going over things a second time. And right, so the title of the chapter is Framing Activities and Framed Mechanisms. and this is sort of like the basic duality in Guiye's approach to mechanisms in general, or like the relationship between conscious actions, or the actions that are brought about by a conscious being, like a human being, for instance, although he also sees certain biological processes as having this nature, and then on the other hand, the mechanisms that result from this. So in the case of these, like one of the examples that he talks about is one, this, I can't remember exactly who introduced it, but it's something that cyberneticians talked about, is this man in the middle process, where you have like the operator of an anti-aircraft gun, for example. You have a radar device, so this is obviously a machine that receives, you know, electromagnetic signals that, you know, vary depending on what is in the surrounding area. And then that signal is transduced into a representation on a screen that a human operator can use to identify whether there are objects flying around in the area surrounding the radar installation. And then, you know, obviously have to determine, is that object an enemy bomber plane, or is it a flock of geese? Because your response is obviously going to be very different depending on how you interpret that, you know, dot on your screen. And then when the person, you know, makes that determination about what this dot represents, then they make a decision and, you know, I don't know, press a button or pull a lever or whatever, and, you know, either launch the nuclear missiles and destroy the world, or they, set off some anti-goose device, I guess, to scare the geese away, whatever, you know, setup is there. But in any case, you have this like chain of mechanisms leading in that, you know, transmit the information from the electromagnetic waves, you know, being reflected off of this object all the way to the screen that the operator views. And then you have the person in the middle. And then you have another chain of mechanisms that leads away from the person, some sort of effect produced by, you know, pulling the lever or pressing the button or whatever it is. So this is like, you have like, in this case, you have the machines on both ends of the chain of, you know, the whole sort of process. You have machines at the start, a person in the middle, and then machines at the end. And so here the machines are sort of framing the person. And this kind of chain, or this kind of sequence, allows you to replace that person. Often you can actually get better results by, you know, replacing the person with a machine. The machine won't get tired, or I don't know, decide that maybe nuclear war is a good idea. We should start a nuclear war just for fun. The machine will just sort of do what it's supposed to do in a reliable way, as long as the background conditions are adequate, that it's not overheating or whatever. However, what Guiye wants to sort of point out is that even in this case where we have this chain where the machine is on the outside, this chain is always sort of embedded in a larger chain where a human being is on the outside of the chain, or human decision making is sort of in framing the chain made up of machines and possibly human decisions, you know, intertwined with it. So in the case of this like anti-aircraft gun installation, someone had to decide, first of all, that defending our country against enemy bombers is an important thing to do. And secondly, that this location is a good place to put up a radar installation to, you know, ensure that we can identify enemy bomber planes, et cetera. Like all these decisions had to be made to bring about the actual construction of this radar installation at this place, and to have a person trained and assigned the task of operating this radar installation, et cetera. All these human decisions had to be performed before the chain with or without a person in the middle could ever be set up. And what he kind of insists on throughout this chapter is that all these little devices, like the artificial tortoise that we talked about in previous sessions, that the cyberneticians kind of point to as like examples of how you could replace the sort of the role of the person. These are all instances of the first type of chain with a person in the middle, where like decision making is like sort of included in a chain of machines, coming in and going out. But they always sort of neglect the fact that there's actually a person setting up that chain in the first place. So like in the case of the artificial tortoise, I think I mentioned this like last time or in the last couple sessions, that like the fact that the light sources are a reliable indication of where the charging stations for this artificial tortoise are, like the just the structure of this environment, is something that has to be set up by the person in like designing the experiment. And so this sort of seemingly goal-directed behavior and or seemingly like adaptive behavior of the tortoise in seeking out the charging station that allows it to recharge its battery is only possible because the environment is set up in this way. So if you just like moved the light sources to some other location that wasn't attached to the charging stations, then the artificial tortoise would direct itself away from the charging station and towards the light, and then just deplete its battery and die. So it would not be at all adaptive. It would not have any capacity to sort of recognize, oh, the light source is no longer leading me towards the charging station, so I should stop following the light source. I should use some other signal to identify where the charging station is so that my battery doesn't deplete. That would be like something more analogous to a living being that sometimes uses signals like that light source. So there are organisms that seek out light or avoid light, but are also to varying degrees capable of learning that what was previously a reliable indication of something to seek out or something to avoid no longer has that value, and they have to change their approach to that indication. Even like quite simple organisms will move up a gradient of a certain chemical that is a sign of the proximity of a food source. So if they detect that the concentration of this chemical is increasing in a certain direction, they will move in that direction, and normally this leads them towards a food source that they can consume. But if you sort of set up the environment in like an artificial setting in such a way that this is not actually a reliable signal of where the food source is, and maybe something else like a light gradient or a sound or whatever is a better indication of where the food source is, then some animals will actually learn to ignore the smell or taste or whatever concentration gradient of chemical concentration gradient, and instead use the light gradient as their way of navigating towards the food source. Whereas, of course, the machines can only follow what they have been built to do. They have certain preset ways of operating, and so you could add like another layer to your artificial tortoise that allows it to learn. Don't follow the light source, follow, a radar detection device instead. But you would have to sort of build that in to the machine. You wouldn't be able to give it sort of this open-ended learning ability that some animals have, to varying degrees. And so that's sort of like the bigger picture of this chapter, is just this distinction between just sort of insisting on the fact that this open-ended capacity to adapt is always sort of presupposed by all these more restricted forms of adaptation that, in some cases are fairly impressive. This artificial tortoise seems to be doing something similar to like a simple organism, kind of adapting to its environment. but it's only capable of doing that because that more open-ended sort of capacity to set goals and achieve them that human beings have was already sort of presupposed in setting up the environment in this way. So that's sort of like the bigger picture of the argument in this chapter. Okay, so let's start reading from page 55 at the heading break, if someone would like to pick up from there.
I can read.
Science and the frame. Science is much more at ease in explaining the mechanical or semi-mechanical median region of actions than in understanding their origin and end. Doctrines such as existentialism, psychological conceptions that address the I, quote-unquote I, such as those of William Stern or Mary W. Calkins, and biological or psychological vitalist theories are hardly welcomed. The same is true for Platonic or Husserlian philosophies of essence, for axiology, or for the theory of organic types. In short, science neglects everything that is quote-unquote framing, whether it is the quote-unquote agent or the quote-unquote ideal. When there are several nested quote-unquote means, for example, when the operation of an auxiliary device is itself nested in the half-operating action of the psychological set, this quote, law of negligence, unquote, is even more striking. The more, quote unquote, central the means, the clearer and more scientifically accessible they are. There is nothing clearer than the operation of a thermostat, an elevator, a directional gyrosperry, or a slide rule. The operation of a physiological set is already more difficult to understand. Even more difficult is the action of a psychological task. The psychologists at the Würzburg School, like the psychoanalysts, have been accused of pseudoscience. Finally, the action or nature of the will, of the quote-unquote I or of the organic X, the intentional relationship of the quote-unquote I to an ideal, is quite mysterious. So we understand that science has always tried to interpret the framing elements, 1 and 4, starting from the framed elements, 2 and 3, the encompassing actions starting from the auxiliary functioning encompassed. Cybernetics is only the latest, most precise, and most interesting attempt to reduce the whole quote-unquote framing to auxiliary functioning. And yet, only instinctive or voluntary motivations give meaning and possibility to auxiliary assemblies. Isolated assemblies make no sense and are literally nothing. The automata of cybernetics, having no motivation, are not beings. Gray Walter's automata are pure passages from stimulus to response, while real beings go toward their goal by way of means and obstacles. Automata actually operate according to a framing will, that of their constructor. They are auxiliary machines for the constructor, like all man-made machines, and it is absurd to use an auxiliary as a model to understand the autonomous being. The mechanical causal sequence from 2 to 3 and the causal and thematic sequence of the psychological set, which is at the same time a, quote, push a tergo, unquote, and an, quote, orientation toward an optimum, unquote, from 1A to 3A, imply the finalist action 1 through 4. The mechanical sequence is without consciousness. The action of the psychological set is subconscious, but the whole is set up by intentional consciousness. In the experiments with Dr. Ashby's homeostat, the set is represented by the various adjustments of the assemblies. Dr. Ashby makes a mistake of vocabulary or designation on this subject that appears unimportant, but which is of great consequence for philosophical interpretation. He considers the interventions of the experimenter as representing the, quote, modifications of the environment, unquote, and the rest of the apparatus is representing the brain that has to adapt to these modifications. This is a serious confusion. The environment and its changes often impose a task, quote-unquote task, on us. For example, the lowering of the temperature imposes on us the task of raising the thermostat's temperature, its thermostat's thermometer. But it is the living being himself who must, quote, rise to the task, unquote, in order to respond to the change. The brain is therefore represented by the entire homeostat, including various assemblies, and not only by the part of the apparatus that responds to the constraints that the experimenter imposes on the other part. Consciousness is represented by the intervening experimenter, which means that it is not explained at all by the apparatus. It is precisely the action of taking on the task imposed by the environment. taking on a task through a set is not the same as being subjected to it. Yeah, so part of the point here seems to be that it's just easier to understand the framed elements than it is to understand easier to study and explain, you know, machines that are used in the, finalist action, or the mechanical, physical aspects that are used in the action, and more difficult to understand the kind of axiological aspect, the basically finalist intention that, you know, is represented by 1 and 4 in this this model that Rouillet has given us. And I think that Rouillet sees the functioning of these machines as sort of like these physiological or psychophysiological sets. So they only operate in order to bring about some goal for which they have been designed in the first place. And it's the goal that kind of, you know, that gives the unity to the machine, and machine sort of borrows the purpose of the inventor. And the functioning of the machine, as we've discussed, has to be sort of supplemented at points by some, you know, inventor or operator who is human, or, you know, is a living being who can keep the goal in mind and kind of regulate the machine when it starts malfunctioning.
Yeah, I think even before you get to like the sort of supplementation side of things, that like there's already the question of like, why is the machine set up in this way in the first place? So in the case of like the thermostat, you have a machine that's set up to, you know, maintain the temperature at a certain level or within a certain range. And this, you know, you can, this could be a replacement for a person. You could have like a person who stands next to the furnace with looking at a thermostat or looking at a thermometer, and, you know, shoveling more coal in when the thermometer goes down, and opening the vent when the thermometer goes up, and just sort of constantly trying to keep the temperature in a certain range. It's like not a very rewarding task, but, you know, many tasks that people were assigned throughout human history have not been especially rewarding. This is something you could, you know, assign your servant to do. But then if you replace that servant with a machine, you probably get a more reliable temperature maintenance function, and it probably costs you less as well. But of course, someone had to decide that maintaining a temperature at a certain level was a goal that was worth pursuing in the first place, and either assign a person to do it or set up a machine that would perform that function. So you could instead, I don't know, decide that constantly increasing temperature is the goal you want to pursue. And so, you know, have the servant just shovel more coal into the furnace at all times, or have you can't really call it a thermostat anymore, but have some sort of device that constantly increases the temperature of the furnace. Or you could, you know, and, you know, yeah, this sounds like American environmental policy. Or, you know, and the decision that it's this range in particular that you want to keep it at, you know, whatever, 22 degrees or, you know, sort of the normal, what we consider room temperature. You know, you could decide, you know, I want to keep my house at 10 degrees Celsius instead. I'm training myself to live in a post-apocalyptic society where there's no more internal heating, and I want to keep my house at a colder temperature instead. I don't know, for whatever reason, you could just decide that you're going to set the temperature of your thermostat to a different temperature, or, you know, set it to 40 degrees Celsius because you want to prepare for our climate change induced future, where the whole world or where your region is going to be a much higher air temperature. You had to, or someone at some point had to decide, I'm going to set the thermostat at this level, or I'm going to, you know, put a thermostat in this building in the first place. And And so this is where sort of the role of consciousness intervenes for Huye. Is not so what the sort of mistake that he's criticizing Ashby for is like having consciousness be only inside the mechanism. Like the consciousness for Ashby is like the servant that is shuffling coal into the furnace when they notice the thermostat declining, and here consciousness is just sort of like you have the stimulus or this input of, you know, the thermostat is below the target level, and then you have a response, which is shovel more coal into the furnace, and consciousness is just sort of like this like thing for filling in the gap in this circuit, but this is something that can easily be replaced by a machine because you can just, you know, have a thermostat that does the same thing. But that sort of obscures the fact that someone had to, you know, either assign this task to the servant or set up the thermostat. And this is like the much more important role of consciousness that Huye wants to insist on is like, you know, making that decision that maintaining temperature in this particular region is a goal that is worth pursuing. And here's how I intend to ensure that goal is realized. Yeah, exactly. So Bat's put here. Yeah. So being able to realize or decide that there is a problem to solve at all is precisely where consciousness seems to come into play primarily. Yeah. You have to. So Ashby is already sort of starting from the point where the goals are set, and even most of the like mechanism that's going to realize this goal is set, and consciousness only intervenes in like, you know, plugging in some of the gaps that like are left behind, you know, where one piece of the mechanism doesn't connect with the other, and you have to like, you know, hire your servant to shovel coal into the furnace. So it's not the case that consciousness can't do that, but that is sort of a secondary role of consciousness that presupposes the sort of prior form of consciousness, which is like deciding that keeping the temperature steady is something, you know, worth pursuing in the first place. So this is what he wants to sort of like shift our attention away from this sort of consciousness as plugging a gap in the you know, ongoing sequence of machines towards like consciousness as setting up that sequence of machines in the first place, you know, to achieve a certain goal. Okay, so yeah, we can go on to the next bit, the axiological frame. Bats, would you like to read from there? I think this might be the end of the chapter, actually. It takes us to the end of the chapter.
Okay, yeah, I can read. The axiological frame. It is remarkable, however, that the most positivist value theorists, such as Stephen G. Pepper, who claims to be a follower of Ralph Barton Perry and Edward C. Tolman, are led to schemas very similar to those we have proposed. In order to describe a real activity, for example that of the aviator who, after falling into the sea, is hungry in his dinghy and sets out to catch fish, Pepper insists on the need to clearly distinguish the quote-unquote governing propensity, here hunger that seeks to achieve a state of appeasement, acquiescence pattern, and subordinate acts, here fishing, tending towards a defined goal object, the fish as food. This gives the following schema. We have here a schema in three parts. On the left side, we have the governing propensity, which has two parts in it, tendency and the anticipating set. Then in the middle, we have the subordinate acts. And then on the right, we have the goal, which itself divides into two, the goal object and then the state of appeasement. The operation of the hook or net can itself be regulated in quote-unquote subordinate acts. However, according to Pepper, the quote-unquote governing propensity is clearly the primary dynamic factor in the whole structure of action. The subordinate acts, and we will add the mechanical operations used, are subordinate to the quote-unquote anticipatory set, which itself depends on the drive, just as the goal object is subordinate to the quiescence pattern and the value of the fish as an object is subordinate to the value of quote-unquote appeasing hunger. A machine can imitate quote-unquote subordinate acts. It can even contain, as we have seen, the approximate equivalent of the anticipatory set, and reach the goal object by itself. But it is inconceivable that a machine encompasses the governing propensity and the quiescence pattern, and that it is an autonomous source of value or of value awareness. And yet, It is quite clear that value and awareness confers here in relation to framed operations. Let us try to adopt the hypothesis of cybernetics and consider man acting as a pure automatic machine. What do we gain from this hypothesis? We simply push back the problem by making it more acute. If the man who, desiring to be warmer, raises the thermometer of the boiler, is still himself like a mechanical device, if the desire, quote-unquote, to be warm, is materially inscribed in his brain, as the temperature he desires is materially inscribed in the device, and if this desire is nothing other than the material inscription, then by whom is it written? By which super-engineer or super-user? If the engineer is the same, in principle, as his automata, then who is the engineer who made the engineer? We do not claim that there is not, in the brain, at the moment when it performs a defined task, a material arrangement regulating the action of its nervous feedback. But the active establishment of the set is necessarily a characteristic of the real being, of which the visible brain is the appearance or the organ. If the action itself, 1-4, is in reality only a mechanical operation, it will be necessary to have recourse to a god, or rather to a demiurge, childishly imagined as an engineer and manufacturer. If on the contrary it is accepted, in accordance with the facts, that each of the nesting systems differs qualitatively from the nested systems, that the psychological set is different from the mechanical assembly, and that the conscious intention in turn differs from the psychological set, then we will have a means of glimpsing through a kind of qualitative extrapolation the nature of what frames the activity of man and of all living beings.
Actually, we can stop here. Yeah, sorry, underestimated how much time we had left, or how much there was left in this section. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a bit long.
This bit about the engineer thing is kind of important here, I think, because this is sort of the typical, I guess, sort of debate that you have like between sort of creationists and evolutionary theorists. Where the creationist says like, oh, this is, the vertebrate eye is too complicated to have, evolved through natural selection. So someone had to have designed it. But Ruyer points out here, this just sort of pushes the problem back one step further, because then you have, like, if you have some intelligent being that is designing vertebrates' eyes, then the question is like, is that intelligent being is even more complicated than, a vertebrate eye. So like that intelligent being would itself have to have been designed by like an even more intelligent being. Of course, the intelligent design is sort of like a sort of disguised version, a way of presenting just a purely religious argument where you just sort of skip the whole step of like engineer and super engineer and you go straight to God as the explanation. The sort of alternate way of doing things that Ruyer is trying to sort of steer us towards is like kind of avoiding like, yeah, getting away from the mechanism with an engineer sort of picture that like, if you only ever consider living beings as mechanisms, then you are sort of like, there's a sort of natural tendency to want to find, an engineer that set up this mechanism. The standard like Darwinian picture is a mechanistic picture that asserts that you can get away with just machines all the way down with no engineers, and obviously has had a lot of success in explaining a lot of different elements of the development of living beings over evolutionary history without having to, appeal to an engineer that had designed the machines or the mechanisms that make up those living beings. But what Ruyer is kind of suggesting here is that this can only get us so far. And this sort of temptation to see an engineer behind it is always going to recur. If we only ever think of living beings as mechanisms, then even at the level of like molecular biology, for example, you have like, the way that certain codons in DNA in all living beings that we have identified, correspond to particular amino acids that are used to construct proteins. And like what's pretty incredible about this is that the pairing is like seemingly arbitrary, that like there's no reason why this precise sequence of codons would correspond to this particular amino acid. It seems like it should be possible to, you know, restructure it in a different way. But then at the same time, this seemingly arbitrary sequence is present in all living beings, you know, animals, plants, fungi, bacteria, etc. So like this is something that, you know, some like intelligent design people that are like a little bit more sophisticated point to this to say, oh, this is like a sign that, you know, this designer sort of intervened right at the beginning to, you know, set up this, you know, alphabet of like this sort of genetic alphabet, and then sort of started the evolution machine going from there, and everything sort of progressed from there. So like, if you only ever look at the machine aspect, or you only ever look at living beings as machines, then there will always be some like either gaps in the middle that you have to, that someone will be able to say, oh, you need an engineer to plug this gap, or like the sort of outset of the machines, like the starting point, setting up the genetic alphabet, for example. This is something that, you know, requires an engineer to get the whole thing going. And he wants us to sort of shift away from that like machine picture that kind of always leaves the hope of finding an engineer at the end of the whole thing, or the beginning, I guess. And sort of look at the way that living beings actually are kind of, I mean, to the extent that living beings are machines, that, you know, there certainly are machines in living beings, or mechanisms in living beings, they're entities that bring about their own machines. And this is quite different than the engineer who, like, you know, picks up some materials and turns them into a machine to achieve their goals. So this is like it's a kind of autonomous turning into a machine, as opposed to heteronomous being made into a machine. Yeah, so the question that Bats has brought up in the chat here is whether this is a sort of necessity, this like engineer idea is a necessity. Could you not? So like I mentioned in the case of like Darwinian evolution, I mean, Darwin himself was not sort of a purist in terms of his natural selection arguments. Like, he thought there were other forms of evolution going on. But if you have like a sort of purist Darwinian approach to evolution, the only thing that's going on is natural selection. You know, certain organisms are more likely to reproduce than others, and the traits that affect the likeliness to reproduce are at least partially heritable, and then the consequence is that, you know, the traits that increase the likelihood of reproducing are going to become more common in the population. And this is like, that's all there is to it. It's just the sort of statistical properties of sets of machines that, you know, we happen to identify as living beings. And that's the whole explanation for the whole history of life. Yeah, so this, it does seem like this is sort of consistent. There's no like contradiction in this picture. But there are like, again, that sort of genetic alphabet fact is kind of it seems arbitrary in this picture. Like, and this is something, so Jacques Monod, for example, important, I believe he won the Nobel Prize, French molecular biologist, his, like one of his big sort of popularization books was called Chance and Necessity. And so his, like, his whole sort of framework for understanding biology is you have these sort of chance events that get sort of crystallized, I guess, into like the later development of biology. And then you have the necessity through the sort of operation of evolution. And so like this genetic alphabet would just be this sort of chance occurrence that, like, for whatever reason, the initial, like the first self-reproducing organism had its, you know, its sort of molecular machinery set up in such a way that it, you know, that this sequence of codons in the DNA, you know, what corresponded to this amino acid, and it just sort of preserved that evolutionary accident over the whole course of, you know, the multi-billion year evolution of life. So that's consistent. I don't think there's any contradiction in that picture, but it's also not that satisfying to say that, like, this sort of like basic element that we find in every single living organism that we've ever encountered is just, you know, an accident that happened billions of years ago and just never got changed. it sort of, yeah, it's not very satisfying. And it also sort of leaves open the possibility of, you know, suggesting, well, maybe it's not an accident. Maybe it's, you know, this engineer that set things up this way for a reason that we don't understand, or maybe no reason at all. But in any case, it's not just an accident. It's the result of a decision of some kind. And, you know, to the extent that this sort of mechanistic Darwinian picture was supposed to, like, replace the need to appeal to a creator that would have designed each species or each type of organism, it does sort of remove the need for this individual design of each species, but it still sort of kind of pushes back the problem to, like, the starting up the whole history of life in the first place. You can't really, decisively shut down the appeal to the engineer in the way that maybe they had wanted to do. So you kind of just push back the problem of, like, the design of the machines. You can say, oh, these, you know, all the different organisms that we see today are not themselves designed, but the sort of basic molecular machinery that allows for, you know, the production of proteins based on a DNA template, that itself was designed. So you're sort of, like, displacing the problem rather than getting rid of it.
He doesn't seem to pursue this point, because the next paragraph starts with him saying, in any case. But after he says that if, you know, the 1-4 sequence is a mechanical operation, then he then says, you know, and dismisses that idea as childish. He then says, if on the contrary, with the facts that each nested system differs qualitatively, the nesting system differs qualitatively from the nested systems, so that, you know, there's a qualitative difference, conscious intention in the psychological set. He says, we'll have a means of glimpsing through kind of extrapolation nature frames the activity man and all beings. So that doesn't seem to be something that he's rejecting. He seems to be saying that if we don't see 1-4 as entirely mechanistic, we can still do this kind of superset extrapolation, but one that passes through qualitative differences at each stage. It's a very interesting and strange suggestion, though. Shoot.
Yeah, I think it was okay. Yeah, we there was a little bit of cutting out, but I think I think I was able to get everything. I'm just sort of going through this bit again. So I think the idea here is that they're not that, like, sort of sophisticated examples, like, you know, the one with, like, you know, trying to get to a location as fast as you can, and, you know, this is sort of like the general, this is like the 1-4 part of the chain, and then the 2-3 part is, you know, pressing on the accelerator of the car and the car goes fast. So here you have this sort of qualitative distinction in the sense that the 1-4 parts of the chain are related to the psychological or this conscious goal setting and decision making, and then the 2-3 parts are you know, mechanical, but you can, of course, you know, insert the 1-4 in a bigger chain, 0-5, and that might sort of make it mechanical. Like, if you have, I don't know, like, if you're a traffic engineer designing the road system of the city and setting up the traffic lights and so on, then you are sort of treating each of the individual drivers as, like, components of your system. And you will, you know, set things up so that they will behave in certain ways. And so the individual driver who has this goal of getting home as fast as possible is sort of made to function as a component of this system. But then again, you can insert that, you know, chain where the traffic engineer is the you know, external consciousness into, I don't know, maybe, like, the planning of the city as a whole. Where, you know, the you know, traffic engineer is just one component of the overall, you know, urban planning system, and et cetera. You can just sort of keep going back and forth, like, sort of nesting a machine inside a consciousness, inside a machine, inside a consciousness, et cetera. And I think the idea here is that, like, we can sort of take our own, like, if you just take a human being in general as, like, this entity that is, you know, conscious and capable of setting goals for itself and so on, then you can sort of extrapolate and suggest that there might be a machine within which human beings, as these, you know, beings that have this kind of autonomy, would be framed. So yeah, it's a kind of extrapolation from the fact that you can keep doing this sort of alternating nesting between machines and consciousness. You can suppose that even at the most sort of external consciousness level that we can suppose of ourselves, then there would be some other machine outside that, and presumably also another, I guess, something analogous to consciousness. So probably not exactly the same as you know, consciousness in the case of human beings, but presumably this alternation just keeps going as many, you know, times, as many iterations as you wanted to. Yeah, so Bat's put here, would the man in the middle example be an example of a machine itself trained by an engineer, which involves inside a human that inside this framing is itself having to make decisions and frame other problems for his operations inside the machine? Yeah, so like you can, if you zoom into like the human in this radar operator example, like you ignore everything about how the radar device actually operates, you know, reflecting, you know, electromagnetic waves and so on. Like you could train a radar operator without any, like the radar operator has never actually seen like the dish and everything outside that is actually, making this radar work. You just, you know, train them that if you see this dot, then press this button. And if you see a dot that does this, press this other button. So the whole like functioning of this, you know, system of the radar operator sitting inside the control room is just a sort of task of like recognizing what these dots on a screen are doing. And it, you don't even have to tell them that, you know, certain types of dot behavior represent a plane and certain other types of dot behavior represent a flock of geese. You just sort of train them to do one thing in one situation and something else in a different situation. So for this person, the goal is like, I don't know, doing what my commanding officer tells me to do so that I don't get disciplined as a, you know, in the military. As a sort of sub goal to achieve that goal, it's, you know, I'm going to watch these dots as well as I can and press the right button. And, you know, so you could have a sort of goal and decision making sort of process going on in the case of this person, you know, staring at the screen. But then if you, you know, zoom out a little bit, then of course that goal and decision making is actually itself, you know, incorporated in the functioning of this machine where the person is sort of like replaceable by another mechanism that instead of having a person looking at the screen and identifying the dots behavior, you could have some sort of device that would, you know, take in signals coming from the radar and determine whether it's a bomber plane or a flock of geese. So each of, like, the question of like machine versus consciousness is partly a question of scale, like where are you zooming in and like how much of the chain is actually incorporated in the frame that you're including.
Seems like for Rouillet, you know, even in the case of the man, there would be a difference in, like, even if, you know, the man is a sort of perfect radio operator, shows up, is very, very good at picking out the dots, that the kind of dot that he needs to pick out, there would still be this what he refers to as a translation from axiological into geometrical space going on for the model employee radio operator, which would in principle never happen for the machines that he is situated in between.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Maybe the difference here is that before this radar operator becomes this, you know, ideal radar operator who never makes a mistake and never gets tired and whatever, you know, before all that happens, this person is actually a human being that, you know, has decided to join the military or been conscripted or whatever, that has, you know, learned how to read, you know, has done all kinds of other things. And, you know, presumably also at the end of the shift, goes home and, like, I don't know, does something other than staring at dots on a radar screen. So like this is a person who has like been trained and trained themselves to perform this task. So that they've like out of all the many different things that they are capable of doing or maybe would have been capable of learning how to do, they have ended up through whatever circumstances, you know, becoming a radar operator that has this skill. Whereas in the case of these, like if you replace the radar operator by, you know, some sort of device that, you know, analyzes the incoming signal and detects whether it's a enemy plane coming in, this device is like sort of purpose built for this one function, or potentially, you know, maybe you have a few different functions that this, maybe you have like a general purpose computer that analyzes all sorts of incoming signals, you know, not just radar signals, but many other kinds of signals. But in any case, you have like a device that is sort of set up to perform either this specific function or a certain class of functions. And your device doesn't, you know, go home and watch TV afterwards or, you know, have a conversation with its friends or whatever. It's something that doesn't have, I mean, we use the term like having a life, you know, you say like on your colleagues have a life outside of work. But here, this is like in the very literal sense, the machine doesn't have a life outside of, you know, detecting whether the radar signal indicates an incoming enemy plane. Whereas the human operator does have a life, you know, even the most like dedicated and sort of the sort of like ideal employee, you know, doesn't literally sit at the radar screen 24 hours a day. At minimum, they have to, you know, go home and sleep, and then they probably have dreams and so on. So all these different sort of, there's all kinds of things that make the human operator not purely a component of the machine, of the whole sort of chain of machines, in contrast to the, you know, device that replaces the human operator. And this is partly, you know, in these types of situations, partly what makes the replacement appealing to the people who are designing these processes is, you know, that you don't have to worry that maybe this device will decide not to obey orders, or that it will get tired and make the wrong decision or whatever. Precisely because the device doesn't have a life outside of, you know, performing this detection function, it sort of minimizes the risk that it will, you know, not perform that detection function the way you expect it to.
Yeah, I think, at least as I understand what he's saying, it seems like, you know, even if you had like radar operator in like, let's say like, I don't know, there's a like automation in the next room over, there's a mechanical device that has like taken the job of his previous coworker, and like they're doing exactly the same thing at the same time. I think that Rouye would still say like there's axiological in the operation of, you know, in the pure, like even if they output exactly the same data, there would still be the like an axiological depth to the experience of human radar that just wouldn't be there for the machine that had replaced the other one.
Yeah, you can imagine like, yeah, you have, suppose you have, yeah, one, you know, radar power is being, you know, operated by the human who's looking at the screen and, you know, detecting, seeing if the dots look like an incoming plane or not. And then the other one, you know, the next room over is, you know, there's a computer that's doing the same thing. You know, it's possible that the human would say like identify other patterns that had not been sort of assigned to them, that like, oh, I noticed that like every day after 4 p.m. there's like something that looks like a flock of geese, but then turns out to be a plane. So like maybe the enemy air force is like trying to trick us or you know, on this like regular pattern or whatever, you know, I don't know, I'm making something up. It doesn't necessarily make any sense to like someone who actually knows about how radar works. But the idea is that like the human is not just detecting, it's not just performing this task, you know, plane versus flock of geese, but they can, you know, just by virtue of the fact that they have this life outside of that one task, they can potentially learn something different about the pattern of information coming in, and, you know, identify something that that they, you know, were not assigned to identify, or that they like were not told this to watch for. Whereas the computer, you know, all the same information is coming in, but it doesn't have any, you know, life outside of that, you know, discrimination task of like plane or not a plane. So anything that doesn't sort of contribute to, towards, you know, like identifying plane versus not plane is just discarded. And you know, depending on how much other, you know, information or what other input that person is receiving, they might have like thoughts about whether this is a good place to set up a radar tower. And like, if they sit there and like they only ever detect geese, never once detect a plane, they might say, okay, this is like probably not a great location for a radar tower, and maybe like my job here is not that useful. Whereas the computer is happy to just, you know, output not a plane as many times as you need it to. So like, yeah, just the sort of possibility of, you know, learning something or coming up with an idea of like, you know, whether this is a useful thing to be doing, et cetera. Like all these things are, even when like for, yeah, temporarily the input output function might be the same in both cases, like they might be performing the same discrimination task and having the same results. The human can learn something from the longer term pattern of, you know, whether the dots turn out to be geese or planes, whereas the computer, unless you actually like tell it to do that, will not you know, try to learn anything or you know, make any use of that information. Angus, could you expand on that in your comment here in the chat, just like on Mike?
Yeah, I think that it seems like there's you know, even if there's nothing learned, like no difference in output between the human and the machine, it seems like there's like, even if you could, you know, completely unrealistically have, you know, a human being whose performance was entirely identical to the machine for his entire career, and, you know, never like really, maybe they weren't much of a learner and picked up on anything, I think it would still be a difference in kind for Rouye. But, you know, in what exactly that difference consists, you know, other than a kind of hyperspatial grasp of axiological space, still something I'm trying to get my arms.
Yeah, I think in this example of like, say, the person who like just sits there and like every single you know, instance of the goose versus plane detection task is like completely independent, never learns anything about the pattern of you know, what time of day the planes appear or whatever, anything like that. And like, I think Rie might see this as a kind of like mechanization of the person. The person has just sort of turned themselves into a machine, as opposed to like, you know, there being a difference between the computer next door and the person doing this. And to some extent, like what happens in, you know, training someone to, you know, be a soldier, to operate a radar installation or whatever, is, you know, you're turning someone into a machine, that like sometimes, I mean, the radar operator might learn certain things about the pattern of planes coming in, but sometimes you don't want them to actually, you know, try to think about what they're doing. You just want them to do this one task and feed the information, you know, up to someone else who will make that decision. And, you know, yeah, sometimes having the person, you know, making a decision, it can be dangerous if they are missing other information that they, you know, that would be relevant, that they don't have access to. And so for precisely that reason, you want them to just sort of mechanically make that identification of plane or not plane, and not try to make decisions about, like, you know, whether there's a pattern in terms of when the planes appear and so on. So yeah, I think to the extent, if you can suppose that the human and computer performance are the same, that would be an instance of a human sort of mechanizing themselves or being made into a machine, you know, whether it's through like training process in the military or like some sort of monastic discipline or whatever it is. And I think to the extent that there is a difference, it would always go along with the fact that the human could always decide to, you know, quit the military, even if that means, you know, being executed for desertion or whatever, decide, I don't want to be a monk that, you know, recites this verse over and over again every day, whatever it is. But the human, no matter how sort of mechanized they have become, can always sort of make a decision to, you know, change the machines that they have set up their life to be, and you know, set up different machines instead. Whereas, of course, the computer is not going to decide to desert the military, no matter how much you sort of kick it or mistreat it or whatever. You know, when we were talking like a few weeks or maybe a couple months ago now about like this sort of like sci-fi fantasy, but like the android that like, you know, is supposed to be this like perfect servant that will never rebel. Like as soon as you see, as like in any like sci-fi thing, they're like, oh, this computer is designed so that it will never rebel. Like, you know, immediately that that computer is going to rebel. Like this sort of idea that like, I think like this sort of capacity to not just fulfill a particular preset function, but to, you know, decide not to fulfill that function. And even like we were talking about in the case of a draft animal, you know, the horse can just decide, you know, I'm done pulling this plow. You know, I've been doing it for years. It's boring. You can, you know, whip me or refuse to feed me or whatever. I'm just not going to pull the plow. And that's just something that, so that's just something that, you know, animals sometimes do. They just, you know, whatever, like you can sort of use the training, like training is a kind of mechanization of the animal. It's like, you know, setting the animal up to perform this task in a reliable way, so that you can achieve a certain goal. But every once in a while, that machine just fails because the animal decides it doesn't want to do what you thought it should do. And this is sort of like the difference between the machines that we design for ourselves and then these like self-producing machines that are animals, because they're never fully machines. They're never sort of identical to the machine that they become, because they're always capable of, you know, de-mechanizing themselves, I guess, in some sense. They can, you know, the machine that they turn into is not sort of final or definitive. They can always, you know, not be that machine and be some other machine in whatever circumstance. Okay, so we can go on to the next bit, which I think this time should actually take us to the end of the chapter. I think we were on page 57. Is that right? In any case, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
In any case, there must be a frame 0 to 5, which may itself be complex for the whole system of human or organic activity. The animal or man is not an absolute beginning. Tendencies or wills oriented by valences or values, which contain subordinate functions, are themselves enveloped contents. Living beings are not the fabrications of a demiurge or a great engineer who would endow them with a certain number of sensitivities or, quote, variable needs, unquote, in the same way that the engineer arbitrarily gives to his automaton, quote, unquote, sensitivity to light or to charge or to the charge level of his battery. But in a more subtle sense, living beings are, quote, unquote, creatures, quote, unquote, axiological automata, created and, quote-unquote, framed by a transcendent who fixes their nature and the values to which they are sensitive. These values or valences control their actions by a kind of axiological feedback similar but not reducible to the mechanical feedback of automata. Something in animal instincts is imitable by machines. It is possible to make artificial animals that flee from the sight of a cane like a dog, that head for a heat source like a bug, that swim against the current like a migratory fish, that walk in a line like processionary caterpillars. But obviously something in divine art is more subtle than the art of the engineer. The valences that drive instincts, and especially the values that drive human behavior, are not reducible to physiological or even psychological mechanical assemblies, which are there to process them. When a man sets himself an elevated goal, an ideal difficult to achieve in art, morality, or technics, his actions are also controlled at every moment according to the results already achieved by comparison with the ideal sought. Basically, the situation is the same as when Elmer and Elsie, Gray Walter's automatic tortoises, move toward moderate light. But it would be too paradoxical to reduce axiological feedback to mechanical feedback. Living beings are at the same time in physical space and in an axiological space. Psychophysiological assemblies, and already brains, as observable apparatuses, are only projections on geometric space of a reality that overflows them. Visible feedback is only a quote-unquote degenerate, in the sense that physicists use this word, state of axiological feedback. As is already the case with an animal disobeying its instincts, a man who disobeys the ideal that usually keeps him in check is worried, troubled, and dissatisfied. This dissatisfaction can hardly be considered as the epiphenomenon of the oscillatory movements that bring the behavioral effectors back to normal equilibrium. The discomfort one feels when leaving one's axiological path can hardly be equated to the pounding felt under the soles of the feet when one has left one's geodesic space-time and feels, quote-unquote, lead-footed. The strength of an ideal is not reducible to force in the physical sense. It is even the exact opposite. Force in the physical sense is only a statistical appearance of elementary axiological forces. As often happens in the psychological order, it is the higher order action that must give the model of explanation for the elementary action and not the other way around. An artist who lacks the taste to judge himself and his own productions could not progress toward his aesthetic ideal. Taste, or value judgment in general, has exactly the same function in higher acts as sensory information in elementary acts. A quote, ethically colorblind, unquote, person, a man suffering from axiological blindness, doesn't know how to regulate his actions, just as a blind person or a Tibetan doesn't know how to regulate his movement. It is in another transspatial world that man and already animals seeks regulatory information. It is impossible to conceive of a machine capable of regulating and informing itself by value judgment. We can metaphorically, in a mind game, imagine all the efforts of humanity in all areas throughout its history as a vast set of feedback actions in which invisible, and indeed poorly defined and changing, ideals control the already achieved results at every moment. This metaphor is not without value, but it is obviously only a metaphor. Quote, regulation by value, unquote, is something more than a mechanical regulation. People who fear the mechanization of humanity through technology seem to believe that, for example, automobiles, through the power of improvement, will first have automatic steering, then will be able to follow a road on their own according to a program, allowing the owner to stay at home while their car travels. They will then be able to choose their own route according to the roads indicated as scenic by a guide. Then they will be able to explore the roads and determine which are scenic by themselves. These fears are entirely childish, precisely because if axiological feedback is similar to mechanical feedback, it is also essentially different, and above all, it envelops the latter. Something transcendent in man and beyond man will always frame his industrial machines or his physiological machines. Yeah, so this is an interesting thing about the, I mean, obviously in 1958 or whenever this was written, the prospect of a self-driving car was like not even on the horizon. Whereas today there, of course, are, ongoing research projects trying to implement this, so they are not quite as straightforward as people kind of expected them to be about 10 years ago. But, even assuming that, like, say, this self-driving car, driving through traffic function is implemented, we're still a long way from, cars, touring the landscape to decide which routes are scenic. It's funny when this, like, sort of, it's similar to Simon Doe in some senses, where you have this, like, very detailed analysis of, like, the design of this artificial tortoise. And then, like, a few pages later, you have this, like, sort of metaphysical extrapolation that, like, it's kind of a wild ride from, like, here's what a vacuum tube looks like, and I'm going to explain the development of vacuum tubes in excruciating detail. And then, like, to sort of, like, pronouncements about the nature of reality and so on. So the idea here, I think, I mean, this axiological regulation, or I think the idea here, like, what distinguishes this axiological regulation from the mechanical regulation is that it's not sort of preset in the same way that the mechanical one is. So even in the case of these devices like the tortoise that have a certain flexibility of behavior, that, like, they don't sort of, you don't have to tell the tortoise this is the exact location where the charging station is. The tortoise can navigate towards the charging station using the light source, no matter where that light source and charging station are. So there's a certain amount of flexibility. It's not, like, preset in that sense. But at the same time, this, functioning of orienting towards the light source is preset. But in the case of a human being that is sort of oriented toward a value, so in some sense, it's similar to the orienting toward the light source, but, like, writing a great novel, for example, is not, if that's, like, your goal that you set yourself, I'm going to write a great novel. This is something that is, like, well, for one sense, it's much more vague than orienting toward the light source, because, like, what are the properties of a great novel is not something you can sort of, just set out a list of, this is what constitutes a great novel. But at the same time, it's also different because, like, you are partly, like, inventing what it is to be a great novel at the same time as you're doing it, right? Like, the tortoise is not inventing how to navigate towards the light source. Whereas, like, part of what makes a novel a great novel, as opposed to just, like, a competently executed novel, is, the fact that it sort of reinvents what a novel is. that like before this novel was written, it there no one else would have had the like the thought of, you know, writing a novel in this way. And so this like axiological regulation is not sort of oriented towards something that already exists in at least in potential, like this sort of direction towards a light source. It's like sort of transforming its own landscape as it progresses. And so I think this is maybe, you know, this is related to that quality of, I guess, flexibility in the case of like the radar operator who could decide, I'm going to desert from the military. you know, this person who, you know, spent 50 years staring at a radar screen and being the best radar operator ever, you know, on the 51st year could decide, you know, I've done my time as a radar operator, I'm going to desert from the military and write a novel instead. So this is something that there's always this capacity to sort of transform the, I don't know, pattern or structure of the activity of this, you know, what was a machine, like this radar operator is a machine in the sort of military system. But that machine can also sort of transform itself into something different and, you know, set up this different machine based on some sort of maybe not even fully conscious goal or, you know, value that the person is trying to realize.
Yeah, this is a really interesting end of the chapter. And one thing I've been thinking about is whether the axiological goal for VA, whether he thinks it needs to be something that is, you know, distinct and that can, you know, the human being can represent to themselves, or whether it could be something that is orienting and yet also vague or indistinct. Like, you know, for Kant and the Critique of Judgment, the genius doesn't have a clear concept of, you know, the work of art that is being produced, and can't in a way, in order to be. And so, yeah, I'm just wondering if Rouillet would, I guess if he thinks there needs to be something like axiological space. And actually, I think, I mean, obviously Deleuze is heavily influenced by Rouillet. But, you know, he, in Difference and Repetition, the problem, which really I think is Rouillet's virtual, can be created by, like, the condensation of singularities, which I think of, for instance, as, like, Cézanne trying to figure out how he is going to, you know, liberate these formal elements of painting from representation. One singularity could be, like, you know, the use of blank canvas or unpainted space in the kind of field of the you know, entire painting, I guess, could be an instance of a singularity condensed in this process of forming the problem, which is, you know, Cézanne painting in his own style. I don't know if directly addressed.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he actually explicitly talks about this, but the way I would think about it is, I mean, maybe something a little less like, you know, this concept of sort of genius and so on. There's a lot of other elements going into it, but like, I think if we make it something less sort of, I don't know, dramatic, we can just talk about like the, if the value that you're trying to realize is being a friend, you know, being a friend, you know, there are certain, like, you can sort of like have rules, or you can, like, I'm sure there's books about like how to be a good friend that you could read or whatever, but like obviously being someone's friend can't be sort of reduced to like just do these six things and therefore you're a good friend or whatever. Like, part of what it is to be someone's friend is to like have this capacity to adapt to that person's needs and like you know, help that person with whatever they're dealing with and so on, like have this sort of flexibility and openness, and, you know, that you learn from each other and grow together and so on. Like this, I think this is sort of characteristic of this like axiological regulation, that like it's not reducible to like a sort of set of success criteria in the way that a mechanical regulation would be, even, you know, a very sophisticated one, like, you know, a ChatGPT type of system that like you want it, like if you at the sort of broad level or a very high level description, it's like the goal is to like, you know, generate text that is like, you know, fits certain criteria that the user enters at the prompt. This, like, you can sort of evaluate this. The you know, evaluation might be somewhat vague in terms of like whether people think this text, you know, meets the criteria that the prompt had assigned to it. There could be, you know, varying opinions on that, but you know, in principle, this is like a sort of closed task. It's like, you know, the user enters a prompt and the system, you know, outputs a text that is supposed to match this prompt. Whereas, you know, the being a friend is a much more open-ended project, where it's not just that, like, if the person you want to be a friend to does X, then you should do Y. And so I think this is, like, characteristic of this kind of axiological regulation. It has this open-ended quality to it, in that, like, you as the person who is regulating yourself in accordance with a value will undergo a transformation of some kind, like as part of like that regulation itself, rather than just sort of like you know, following these steps or, you know, meeting these criteria to, you know, achieve this goal. And this applies also, of course, to all the, you know, the sort of genius type examples that, you know, you can't like, you know, tell someone if you do these five things then your novel will be great. Like, you can give people like tips for like, you know, how to, you know, increase your chance of writing a great novel, or to the things you can avoid that will definitely make your novel not great. But you can't like give someone a formula for how to write a great novel. The whole like self-help industry of like, yeah, sort of giving you these like lists of things that you can do to, you know, become the perfect mother or the perfect employee or whatever. These are kind of like missing the point of what it is to, like, being a mother obviously is not something you can just say like these, it requires these criteria to be fulfilled, and then you've like done your due diligence and you can like sit back and watch TV the rest of the time. Whatever, all these different things that involve like this relation to a value, they require a kind of openness to reevaluating whether you have, you know, whether what you're doing is actually getting you to what you want to do. And maybe you have to like rethink your whole approach to being a mother or being a friend or writing a novel or whatever it is. Like, maybe you have to throw out your whole draft that you spent like 3 years working on because you decide this is actually terrible. I'm going to start from zero. Sometimes you do have to, you know, transform what you're doing. Sometimes it's just a, you know, making an adjustment of some kind that, like, you know, I was treating my friend in this way, but then I've come to realize that was, you know, not, you know, sort of respectful in this sense because of some other factor. So I'm going to treat my friend in a different way to try to be a better friend. You know, just making these little adjustments, sometimes is also part of what it is to, you know, act in accordance with the value of being a friend. This transformation can be a sort of like a fundamental rethinking and reorientation of your whole life, but it can also be like just these little adjustments. You're writing a novel and you think, oh, actually this chapter, you know, I liked what I wrote, but it doesn't really fit, so I'm gonna have to take it out. Making these adjustments making things sort of fit together in a better way is also part of that same kind of transformation process. Okay, so we are at the end of the chapter. And almost at the, well, sort of approaching the 2-hour mark, so we can stop here and pick up next time. So we will interrupt our reading group machine for the moment, and we will orient ourselves towards the value of continuing discussion of the book next session. So thank you everyone for joining today and for your contributions, and hope to see you next time.